Anya and Garin decided it was prudent to get out of town as quickly as possible. If someone stumbled on the shell casing from the shotgun or noticed the pattern of holes in the hood of that car, they'd have a lot of explaining to do. As always, Anya didn't want to waste time answering questions at the police station. They hadn't been on the road for more than 10 minutes before Anya got an unexpected phone call. A glance at the caller ID showed an unknown number.
Hello?
Miss Creed?
Yes?
You're intruding in something that's not your business, Miss Creed. I suggest you take recent events as a warning and stop while you're ahead.
Who is this?
Garin was looking at her curiously, so she mouthed the order at him and put the phone on speaker.
What you are searching for belongs to me. If you continue to interfere, I'll be forced to take more radical measures.
Yeah? Perhaps next time the Order will send a killer who can actually shoot straight. Tell you what, you give it your best shot. I'll be here waiting.
They said you were smart, Miss Creed, but I'm having a hard time seeing that. Perhaps this will raise your IQ a few points. Anya?
Benna?
Do what they say, Anya. It isn't worth...
Bernard!
I'm sorry, Miss Creed, but Professor Reinhardt isn't able to come to the phone at the moment.
If you hurt him, so help me, I'm gonna...
I don't think so, Miss Creed. You're not the one calling the shots here. I am. I'll say it one more time. Stay out of my business, or both you and Professor Reinhardt are going to regret it.
That is a dead man.
I take it that means you have no intention of turning back now.
Hell no! It's more important than ever that we get possession of the treasure, and quickly, or we'll be too late to help Bernard.
Just checking.
You'll listen to me, you son of a...
Anya?
Sorry, Doug. I thought you were someone else.
Glad I'm not him, that's all I can say. I got what you need.
Already?
It turns out the archaeology department at the University of Atlanta was all too happy to help out the infamous Anya Creed. Especially when I told them you'd be happy to show up for the Chasing History's Monsters Marathon weekend they're planning next month.
You did what? No, never mind. Whatever they want, I'll do it. Tell me about the equipment.
Doug walked her through the entire list, confirming that he'd gotten it all, from the toad magnetometer to the scuba gear.
All I need to know is where to deliver it.
I'll call you back with that info as soon as I have a chance to talk to my riverboat captain. Thanks, Doug. Later.
You're not really intending to give him the treasure, are you?
Not if I can help it.
25 minutes later, they found themselves pulling into the driveway of a beat-up-looking house on the far side of town. A tall chain-link fence enclosed the entire property, and the front yard was filled with various bits of equipment that partially obscured the single-level ranch behind it all. A large dog, a Rottweiler by the looks of it, barked at them from behind the fence.
It'll be a miracle if the guy's boat actually floats.
Quiet.
The front door opened, and a man dressed in grease-stained coveralls stepped out onto the porch.
I'll hurt you!
He was an inch or two shorter than Anya, but what he missed in height he made up for in the width of his brawny shoulders. He seemed friendly enough.
You folks lost?
Depends. Are you Jimmy Mitchell?
Depends. You with the IRS or the Salvation Army?
Nope, neither. We're looking to hire us a riverboat, Captain.
Preferably one with an actual boat.
Does he think he's funny?
He does. We all have our crosses to bear.
Ain't that the truth, Missy? Ain't that the truth?
Mitchell came down off the porch and approached the fence.
Go on now, shoot!
Come on. Come on in. Jimmy Mitchell.
Anya Creed. And the funny guy behind me is Garin Braden.
Mitchell led them across the yard and up to the porch, where he indicated with a wave of his hand that they should grab one of several folding chairs stacked there and have a seat.
Now, what do you need the boat for?
We're trying to locate the wreck of a ship.
Oh, shipwreck, huh?
Anya explained about how the hurricane had pulled the CSS Marietta off the riverbank and sent it several miles downstream. She told him they had a general sense of where it might have ended up, and that they needed him to run several passes up and down the river, towing a magnetometer, to help them pinpoint the actual location. At that point, Anya and Garin would dive to the wreck and do what they could to confirm its identity.
That sounds easy enough. Rentals in 24-hour increments, but you'll have to pay the fuel charge as well.
They dickered for a bit on price, but finally came to an agreement both parties could live with. Jimmy gave them the address of the wharf where his boat was docked, and Anya relayed that to Doug, who informed them that the equipment could be delivered later that afternoon. As they made their way back to the car, Garin glanced at Anya.
About that price, just so you know, it's all coming off the top when we recover the treasure anyway.
If we recover the treasure.
Unable to do anything more until the equipment arrived, the two of them decided to stay out of sight for the rest of the afternoon. The fact that the order had not only tracked them to Washington, but had also managed to get a hold of Anya's cell phone number, showed they had plenty of resources at their disposal. So Anya didn't want to take a chance of being exposed any more than necessary. They found a new hotel near the wharf where they would be meeting Mitchell in the morning and settled in, having both lunch and dinner delivered to them so they wouldn't have to go out. Anya used the time to learn everything she could about the CSS Marietta, researching it on the internet and even speaking to one of the curators at the Museum of the Confederacy in Richmond. By the time she finished several hours later, she thought she was reasonably well prepared for the difficult task ahead of them. Early that evening, she took another call from Doug.
I received word that the equipment has been delivered as promised. I'm going to be sending Richie down to meet you in the morning to get all this on film for the episode.
No! There's limited room on the boat, so I'll just use my handheld and capture the footage myself. We'll have enough to use, I promise.
Oh, all right. Just be sure that you get some decent footage. I don't know how we're going to be using it in the show about reanimated Civil War soldiers in the Paris catacombs, but better safe than sorry.
For the last time, Doug, it's not a show about reanimated...
Gotta go, Anya. Talk to you tomorrow.
The next day dawned cool and clear. Anya and Garin were up with the sunrise and waiting on the wharf when Jimmy Mitchell pulled up in a dilapidated Ford pickup truck. He greeted them with enthusiasm and led the way to the dockmaster's office, where the equipment was delivered the night before. It took about 2 hours to sort through the boxes, unpack the equipment, and confirm that it was all in good working order. When they were finished, they loaded it all on a pair of dollies and moved it down to the wharf so they could load it onto the boat. Their first look at the Kelly May wasn't encouraging. She was a fiberglass fishing trawler with a small wheelhouse set two-thirds of the way back from the bow. A boom mast covered in flaking paint rose up behind the wheelhouse. Normally used to drag fishing nets, it would be used on this voyage to drag the magnetometer. The hull was faded, the name on the side of the boat barely legible. But Jimmy Mitchell stood there gazing at her proudly.
42 feet in length and 14 feet abreast with a 6-foot draft. She'll do 12 knots while carrying 15 tons of cargo.
When Mitchell fired up the engines a few minutes later to warm them for the day's activity, much of Anya and Garin's anxiety was relieved. She might not look like much, but even a non-gearhead like Anya could tell that the engines were masterfully maintained. It took them another hour to load all the equipment and finish filling the tanks with fuel, but by 9 that morning, they were headed out onto the river to start their search. Anya gathered her two companions together over the chart table in the wheelhouse and went through the plan she'd put together to find what they were looking for. Satisfied they all knew their assignments after 20 minutes of discussion, they sat back to enjoy the short trip downstream to the target area. After they had arrived in the general location where the university team had recorded their earlier finding, it was time to get the search underway in earnest. The magnetometer looked like a miniature rocket, with a blunt nose, long tube-shaped body, and a set of fins in the rear. It was 4 feet long and weighed somewhere in the neighborhood of 12 pounds. After assembling it, Garin launched the magnetometer over the side, while Anya played out the line until it was being towed roughly 50 feet behind the boat at a depth of about 150 feet. The device was designed to pick up variations in the Earth's natural magnetic field. Large quantities of iron, like that used in the construction of the CSS Marietta, would alter that field and show up on the device's screen. The accompanying GPS would allow them to note the exact coordinates and reveal the width and length of the debris field as well. As they began the long, slow process of trawling up and down the river, searching for an anomaly with the magnetometer, Jimmy spoke up.
So, tell me about this boat we're looking for.
The CSS Marietta. She's an old Confederate ironclad built back in 1862.
Ooh, cool. What's an ironclad?
Well, basically, it's a steam-propelled wooden warship that's fitted with iron plates for protection.
So they took a steamboat and stuck it in a suit of armor?
Yep, that's pretty much it. There were several different types built during the Civil War, but the most common was the casemate ironclad. Think of it as an armored box with slanting sides built to protect the guns and crew from enemy shot. They often had a reinforced bow that was used to ram enemy vessels as well. The Marietta, the ship we're looking for, was a casemate ironclad.
That means it should light up the magnetometer like a Christmas tree.
That's the hope, anyway.
As if on cue, a section of the magnetometer suddenly bloomed with color. Mitchell slowed the boat to a crawl, letting the magnetometer get a good long look. The men turned expectant gazes in her direction. But after studying the readings for a moment, Anya had to shake her head. The object, while certainly iron, was too small to be the Marietta.
More like somebody's old hot water heater.
Anya guessed there had been plenty of junk dumped into the river over the years, and they were likely to get a lot of false positives before they found the real target. To try and limit that as much as possible, Anya moved the gamma setting from 3 to 9, ensuring that they would only pick up larger concentrations of iron, and signaled to Mitchell to get the boat moving again. By mid-afternoon, they'd stopped 4 more times. Each time, Anya had suited up in a wetsuit and scuba gear, and with the help of a diving sled outfitted with high-powered spotlights, had gone down into the murky water to take a look. Each time, she'd been disappointed. So far, she had discovered an abandoned station wagon, an industrial-sized boiler, a pile of cast-iron sinks, and much to her surprise, a steam locomotive. The train had just been sitting there on the river bottom, the round bulb of its front light looking like an eye gazing back at her out of the gloom. Seeing it sent her imagination into overdrive, and she found herself wondering what train it was from and how it had come to be here at the bottom of the Savannah River. When she surfaced, she made a note on the charts indicating the find and made a mental note as well to return to the spot one day to learn more. For now, though, they still had an ironclad to find. They were on the very edge of the target area, just finishing off their complete pass, when the magnetometer's alarm went off for the 5th time that day. The display showed a good-sized target, so Anya zipped up her wetsuit and prepared to dive again.
Want me to take it this time?
Thanks, but I've got it.
Suit yourself. Remember to use one of the strobes if you get into trouble. White for marking the wreck and red for an emergency.
Right. Wish me luck.
Anya put her mouthpiece between her teeth and went over the side for the 5th time that day. When she surfaced, Garin handed the light sled down to her, waited until she'd turned it on to check how much battery power was left, and then played out her dive rope behind her as she sunk beneath the surface. The weights on her belt helped her resist the river's current and took her to the bottom fairly quickly. They'd loaded the exact location into the GPS unit she wore on her wrist, so it was a simple matter of following the signal to the site. Except there was nothing there. Or rather, nothing that looked to her like the wreckage of a Civil War ironclad. She began swimming in a wide circle, moving through the target area methodically. At this point in the river, a wide ridge rose up about 10 feet along the bottom, just large enough that she couldn't see over it and long enough that she couldn't see past it in the gloom. She kept it close on her left, keeping it as a reference point so she wouldn't get confused in the murky water.
Damn, it's dark down here.
She'd almost reached the end of the ridge line when she saw something sticking out of the muck at the point where the ridge rose up from the river bottom. Something that looked far too symmetrical and round to be natural. Anya shone the light directly at it. The open mouth of a Civil War-era cannon gaped at her. She finally understood what had been eluding her for the past several minutes. The hurricane must have pushed the wreckage deep into the silt of the river bottom, where it had become lodged against the current. Over time, spring floods and the occasional high-water storm had deposited more and more debris atop the wreck until it was essentially entombed in the earth, forming the underwater ridge she'd been swimming beside. Better yet, based on the size and shape of the ridge, it appeared that the Marietta might have remained reasonably intact, despite the force of the water. Anya felt her excitement grow at the realization. If the ship was intact and she could find a way inside, they might still be able to recover Ewell's rifle and continue the search for the treasure. She gave a powerful kick and began swimming along the length of the ridge, looking for some way inside the hull she knew was hidden beneath. It didn't take long. A shelf jutted out from the rounded side of the ridge, and a school of fish shot out from beneath when her light washed across it. She moved in for a closer look, pointing her light like a beacon into the darkness. She found herself staring at the algae-encrusted edges of a wide hole that had been gouged through the casemate armor that surrounded the hull. Anya didn't know if it happened when the ship ran aground or during the battle that had forced the CSS Marietta to heave to or risk sinking with all hands on board, but it didn't really matter. The hole provided a way inside the vessel. But first, she had to tell the others. She pulled one of the white emergency flare lights off of her belt and clipped it to the edge of the hull. She gave the top a twist, activating the strobe inside it, and then pushed off for the surface, rising through water suddenly lit up with the pulsing white light of the flare. The wide smile on her face must have given her news away. Anya swam over to the boat and passed the light sled up to Jimmy Mitchell. Garin extended a hand to help pull her aboard.
Talk to me.
She's down there all right. Almost completely buried in the mud at the river bottom. Thankfully, she appears to be mostly intact.
So what do you think? Can we get inside?
Yes. I found a hole about 3/4 of the way along the hull that's wide enough for us to swim through.
Did you try to get inside?
Not yet. But it doesn't look like it'll be a problem. I could see down to the lower deck from where I stood outside the gap, and it looks like there's enough room to move around inside. That doesn't mean a bulkhead somewhere hasn't been crushed, or the captain's cabin, where what we need was stored, is still accessible. But at least it gives us a chance.
All right. Take half an hour to rest, and then we'll go down together.
Anya didn't want to wait. She wanted to simply switch tanks and dive immediately. But she knew he was right. Tired divers made stupid mistakes, and mistakes were something they couldn't afford. She used the downtime to grab some water and a quick snack out of the cooler they'd brought along. Rehydrated and feeling energized after the quick sugar rush, Anya prepped the underwater camera she'd be using to take pictures of their incursion inside the vessel, and then changed out her previous breathing tank for a new one.
We're going to use the dive line to get us back to the wreck, but after that, we're going off of it. I don't want to take the chance of having the line get held up on something inside the wreck and end up with one of us trapped down there.
Got it.
We shouldn't be down there for more than an hour. If we run into any trouble, we'll signal with a red strobe. You're not to leave the boat, though. Call for help if you think we're having difficulty.
Roger that. You stay out of trouble, we won't have to worry about any of that.
Anya smiled and gave him a thumbs up. Garin was finished going over his own gear, so he nodded at Anya, and together they disappeared over the side of the boat. Garin was waiting for her just beneath the surface. She swam by him, knowing he'd follow her down as planned. The strobe light she placed near the wreck had started to dim, but was still strong enough for her to focus as she descended. Minutes later, she was hovering just outside the opening, Garin at her side. The dive line was attached to her belt with a carabiner. She unclipped it and then hunted around for a moment until she found a spot on the wreck where she could attach it. That way, they would maintain a link to the boat above, but still be free to move around inside the wreckage without worrying about the line getting snagged on a piece of equipment or preventing them from getting through a tough spot. Garin flipped on the handheld spotlight he carried, then signaled that he was ready. Anya did the same with her own light, then slipped through the opening and led the way inside the wreckage. Most of the Confederate ironclads had nearly identical interior layouts, with three decks running through the structure. The first deck, known as the gun deck, was the portion of the main deck that was located inside the protective casemate armor. The berthing deck was a mezzanine-style deck, with its aft compartment fitted around the engine and its accompanying boiler. The third and final deck, the orlop deck, housed all the stores. Just aft of this deck were the water tanks, boiler room, and engine room, with all the machinery you would expect in such an area. Shining their lights around the interior, it was clear that the ship was resting on her side. The floor they were hovering over was actually the port side of the vessel, and anything that had not been bolted down at the time of the hurricane had been strewn about the chamber in a tangled mess. Most of it appeared to be the smashed remains of wooden furniture, which puzzled Anya for a moment until she remembered that the ship had been used as a regional headquarters in the months before the hurricane. She glanced around, orienting herself with her mental understanding of the expected layout, and then pointed to her left, indicating they were to move in that direction. Garin nodded to show he understood. Parker's second clue instructed them to find the lady in distress, and to then take Ewell's rifle from her crest. A ship's crest, also known as a coat of arms, was usually located in the captain's cabin, so it made sense to start there, given they didn't have any indication that it would be found elsewhere. That meant they had to go down one more deck and then move forward toward the bow of the vessel until they located the right cabin. They moved through the open space of the gun deck until they came to a square opening in the wall on their right that Anya recognized as a ventilation shaft. Once covered by a metal grate, the shaft would have allowed cool air from above to filter down below decks, where it was desperately needed. It was wide enough to allow them to pass through without difficulty, and they used it now like a doorway to swim from the gun deck to the berthing deck just beyond. They found themselves staring at a large metal tank that filled most of the space from the floor to the ceiling.
Boiler room.
Anya shone her light beyond it, where she could see a convoluted series of metal shafts, pipes, and gears, marking that space as the engine room. Garin turned his back on the equipment and moved toward the open doorway at the other end of the room. Anya had no choice but to follow, despite her desire to poke about and examine the engine. They passed through the wardroom with its officers' bunks and the galley with its tangled heap of cookware before coming to a narrow corridor with open doors on either side. The second room they checked turned out to be the captain's cabin. It was bigger than the others they'd seen, with a bunk bed built against the bulkhead and a narrow desk nailed to the floor just beyond. The ship's crest, a large wooden plaque cut into the shape of a shield, hung above the desk. Her excitement growing, Anya swam over to it. Up close, it was unlike any crest she'd seen before. Most crests were carved from a single block of wood, so that each of the items that made up the crest were actually part of the whole. In this case, however, the flat surface of the shield was one piece of wood, with each of the adorning items making up the coat of arms having been carved separately and added one at a time. At the top of the crest were two crossed rifles, in this case a pair of Enfield muskets, one of the most common weapons carried by Confederate soldiers throughout the war. A cavalry saber ran vertically through the space behind the center of the crossed rifles, the tip of its blade pointing at the object beneath them, which happened to be the statue of a horse rearing up on its hind legs. Underneath that, at the bottom of the crest, was a ship's wheel. A linked chain, perhaps representing a ship's anchor chain, ran around the edge of the entire device. Garin followed her over, waited patiently for Anya to finish her examination, and then reached up to remove one of the rifles from the top of the crest, only to have Anya put out a hand to stop him. Even through his face mask, she could see him giving her an impatient look. Motioning for him to wait a moment, Anya turned her attention back to the crest and ran her fingers over the statue of the horse.
Take Ewell's rifle from her crest.
Richard S. Ewell had been a Confederate general who fought well under Stonewall Jackson and had taken command of Second Corps when Jackson fell in battle. He'd made a fateful mistake at Gettysburg, failing to push for the heights of Cemetery Hill, despite the discretionary orders he'd received from Robert E. Lee, telling him to engage if he found it to be practicable. The second day of fighting at Gettysburg might have been radically different if he'd done so.
Ewell's rifle wasn't a firearm, but rather the trusted horse on which he rode into battle.
A horse like the one in front of her now. Unable to find a switch or a lever that might release the horse from its position on the crest, Anya grasped it with one hand and tried to turn it. She felt something click beneath the pressure she was exerting, and the statue came free in her hand. Garin had been hanging back, watching her. But when the horse came free in her hand, he crowded close, wanting a look for himself. She passed it over to him and let him examine it for a moment before taking it back. When doing so, she noted that it felt heavier than something that size would normally weigh. signaling to Anya that there was more there than met the eye. She'd have to examine it more closely once they got it up to the surface. Opening the dive bag at her waist, Anya dropped the statue inside. A glance at the dive computer on her wrist told her they'd been down for 20 minutes at this point. At their current depth, that meant they were now at the halfway mark.
Plenty of time to get back to the top.
Anya signaled to Garin that they were ready. She followed him back through the wreckage, the same way they'd come in, until they reached the gun deck and the opening in the hull through which they'd entered the ship. With a nod to her, Garin slipped out of the opening, located the dive line, and using it as a guide, headed for the surface. She turned to follow Garin, only to hesitate at the exit, a sense of unease stealing over her. She'd learned to trust her instincts and listen to that feeling. She extended her arm outside the wreck and waved her spotlight about, looking for she didn't know what. The beam of light could only cut through the water for a short distance before the murk swallowed it up. Still, she thought she saw something swimming through the dark waters at the edge of the light's reach.
It's nothing. That's just Garin.
Anya pulled the spotlight back inside, turned it up to its most powerful setting, and flashed it back in the same direction. This time, there was nothing there. Satisfied, she clipped the light to her belt and leaned out of the opening, her hand groping for the dive line that she intended to follow to the surface. A dark shape rushed forward out of the murky water to her left. She saw it and flinched backward, her body reacting to the threat before her conscious mind had processed exactly what it was. She caught sight of a scaly hide and a flash of teeth before the alligator's powerful jaws slammed shut just inches from her face. Half a second later, the creature was gone, lost once more in the murk. Heart pounding, Anya backed away from the opening. She knew that contrary to popular belief, alligators actually had excellent eyesight, and being natural predators, were attracted to movement. She was hoping that the creature would just continue on and leave her alone if she didn't give it any reason to come after her. She called forth her sword and felt a little less anxious when her hand closed around the hilt. Armed, her chances improved almost 100-fold. Most alligators avoided human contact as much as possible, and the larger the creatures, the more shy they were. The average alligator was about 12 feet in length, she knew, which put the one she'd just seen well in the upper percentile.
That's one big lizard.
Anya checked her dive computer again and saw that she had another 5 minutes of air, plus a 10-minute safety margin. Hopefully, the alligator would grow bored and wander off long before that. But that wasn't to be. Even as she thought about it being gone, the gator swam back into view. It cut through the water like a torpedo, approaching her hiding place, but not intent on attacking, at least as far as she could tell. It seemed to be just swimming about, waiting for her to emerge from her little cave. She continued backing up. As she did so, she bumped into one of the cannons that had been tossed about by the hurricane. It hit her side at just the right angle to set off one of the emergency strobe lights she had hanging on her belt. The water around her was suddenly filled with a blazing red light that pulsed outward into the darkness. It flashed over the alligator, catching its attention and causing the beast to turn back toward her. It was facing her direction when the next pulse of light went out, and the alligator reacted to it instantly, charging directly toward her. Anya fumbled at her belt with her free hand, trying to free the device, but it was no use. It had gotten stuck somehow and wouldn't come free. She gave it one more tug as the alligator closed the distance between them, and then she had no choice but to take hold of her sword in both hands as the beast was upon her. At the last moment, she turned to her left, evading the snap of the gator's massive jaws and stabbing with her sword. She felt the tip of her blade bite into the creature's flesh as it rushed past, blood spilling into the water. As it swept past, one of its legs lashed out, clawing Anya across the ribs and adding some of her blood to the mix. The creature rushed past her, slamming into the opposite bulkhead thanks to the momentum of its charge. As it righted itself, it lashed out with its powerful tail, sending a stack of three cannons tumbling downward to the floor. For a moment, it was trapped behind a debris pile of its own making. Anya saw her chance. She turned and threw herself toward the opening, trying to get clear of the wreckage while ignoring the pain in her side at the same time. For a split second, she thought about making a run for the surface.
No. If the alligator catches me in the open water, I'll be dead.
So rather than trying to make a run for it, she turned around as soon as she was clear of the opening and positioned herself atop the overhang that covered it, legs braced, shoulder width apart, and the sword held point downward in her two hands.
I'm only gonna get one shot.
Having already tasted the sharpness of her blade, the alligator was more cautious leaving the wreck than it had been when entering, which was exactly what Anya was counting on. It stuck its snout out of the opening first, testing the water. At that moment, Anya stepped off the ledge, thrusting her sword downward with all her might as she fell. Her sword pierced the beast's skull a few inches behind its eyes. It reacted instantly, throwing itself around like a bucking bronco. But Anya wrapped her legs around the creature's neck and held on to the sword with all her might, still pushing downward. The blade slid all the way home, the guard on the hilt coming to rest against the reptile's bony hide. The alligator finally went still. Anya held on, waiting, wanting to be sure before she let go. But when it hadn't moved for several long moments, she finally released her death grip on both the sword and the alligator. The sword vanished back into the otherware as if it had never been, leaving only Anya's blood-covered form and the sinking body of a dead alligator as evidence that it had existed at all. Anya tried to draw in a deep breath from her regulator and got only a thin mouthful of air.
Uh-oh.
A glance at her air gauge told her that she was well into the red. She had only moments of air left. Trying to keep from panicking, Anya hung in the water for a moment, watching her air bubbles. When she saw the direction the air bubbles were rising, she began swimming frantically in the same direction. She almost made it, too. She was only 10 feet from the surface when her air tank ran completely dry. She spit the regulator from her mouth and kicked harder, pushing herself up toward the light shining down from above. When Anya finally surfaced, one of the first things she noticed was the man standing on the stern of the Kelly May, pointing the muzzle of an automatic rifle at her.
You don't listen too good, do you, Miss Creed?
Anya stared up at the speaker, a dark-haired man in his mid-40s standing next to the gunman. Behind him, she could see Jimmy Mitchell and Garin kneeling on the deck, a second gunman standing far enough away that he could keep his weapon trained on them without worrying about being jumped. Three other thugs stood nearby, guns in hand, but not pointed at anyone. All around, it was a good tactical position, and seeing it, Anya knew they were dealing with professionals.
That's gonna make things more difficult.
She turned her head slightly, taking in the large yacht that was tied up next to the smaller Kelly May. That explained where the men had come from. She could see several other men on board the other vessel, which told her they were vastly outnumbered.
Doesn't look like there's gonna be an easy way out of this one.
I thought I was quite clear. Or is there some other way of interpreting, stay out of my business?
Who are you, and what do you want?
Who am I? Oh, that's rich, Miss Creed. Truly. You're being held at gunpoint. And the first thing you care about is being sure we're properly introduced. Let me introduce myself then. Blaine Michaels, at your service. As for what I want, I think we both know the answer to that.
You're after the treasure.
Out of the water, please.
Anya swam the last few feet to the side of the boat. When no one moved to help her up, she pulled herself up and over the stern. After fighting off an alligator and running out of air, that final effort nearly exhausted her. She sat with her back against the gunwale.
The rifle. Where is it?
The what? I'm sorry, I don't know what you're talking about.
Michaels didn't bother arguing with her. He didn't say anything at all, in fact. He just gave a little wave of his hand. Jimmy Mitchell dropped to the deck, his sightless eyes staring in her direction as blood leaked from the hole in his forehead to mingle with the flow pouring out of what was left of the back of his skull after the bullet burst through it.
Why, you?
Anya came halfway off the deck, her hands clenched, struggling to keep from drawing her sword. Michaels and his men were too far away for it to do her any good, and drawing it now would only give away her one real advantage.
You bastard!
Miss Creed, such language. There's no need for it, really. I'll only ask you once more. Where is the rifle?
It's in my dive bag.
Michaels glared at her for a long moment, and she could see in his expression that he was trying to work out how that was possible.
Not as smart as you think, are you?
Michaels turned and looked at one of the thugs watching from the sidelines. The man came over, knelt beside her, and, producing a knife from somewhere inside his jacket, cut the dive bag from her belt. He carried it over to Michaels. Anya watched as Michaels drew open the drawstrings and peered inside.
What the hell is this?
Ewell's rifle.
Turning the bag over, Michaels poured the statue into his hand. He held it up for her to see.
Does this look like a rifle to you?
It does when you understand that the horse General Ewell rode into battle more than any other was named Rifle.
I see.
You've got the statue, now let us go.
Michaels didn't even bother looking in his direction, just inclined his head toward his man with the gun standing nearby. He stepped forward.
No!
He cracked Garin across the face with the stock of his rifle.
If he says another word, kill him.
Across the deck, Garin shook his head as if to clear it. He spat blood on the deck and then pushed himself back to his knees, glaring at the man who'd struck him. The other man smirked and raised the stock of his weapon again, trying unsuccessfully to make his captive flinch, never noticing that the man he thought was helpless before him was now several feet closer than he'd been before.
Not yet, Garin. Not yet.
Blaine Michaels hefted the horse, perhaps noticing the weight of it for the first time, and then looked at Anya.
Let me guess. There's something inside it, isn't there?
Anya shrugged. That was apparently answer enough for Michaels. From where she sat on the deck nearby, Anya could see a small metallic object lying amid the shattered porcelain. In that second, everyone's attention was on the remains of the statue and nowhere else.
Now.
Anya tensed, ready to move. But before she could do so, things took another turn. A pair of figures stepped out onto the deck of the other boat, and Anya's gaze automatically flicked over in that direction. Bernard stood there, his hands tied in front of him, and a blindfold on his face. Beside him was another of Michael's thugs, holding a gun in Bernard's side. As if reading her intentions, Michaels looked up from the debris at his feet.
Going somewhere, Miss Creed?
Anya bit back her reply and released the tension in her limbs. Whatever she'd hoped to do, it was too late now. Over Michael's shoulder, Anya could see Garin come to the same conclusion. Michaels bent down, brushed aside the broken porcelain, and picked up the object that had been hidden inside the statue.
Bring me the professor!
Michaels waited while Bernard was led across the deck and then helped across the gap between the boats. When the professor was standing in front of him, Michaels ripped off the blindfold and held up the object he'd taken from inside the statue.
What is this?
From where she sat on the deck, Anya could see that Michaels was holding a metal disc about twice the size of a half dollar. Another piece of metal had been inserted in the center of the disc, this one in the shape of an eight-pointed star. As she watched, he spun the star so that it rotated within the confines of the disc. Bernard was much closer to the object than she was, and therefore could get a better look at it. But it was clear from the expression on his face that he didn't recognize it.
I'm getting the feeling you don't have any idea what this is. Do you, Professor?
Of course I do. It's, well, I think,
Perhaps it hasn't occurred to you yet, Professor Reinhardt. But your usefulness to me is severely limited if you can't give me the information I need.
Please, just give me a minute. It's coming to me.
It's a Jeffersonian key.
Go on.
They were invented by Thomas Jefferson near the close of the American Revolution. The star on the disc acts as a primitive combination lock, releasing successive layers of the corresponding locking mechanism when inserted into the lock and turned in the proper direction.
It would seem, Miss Creed, that you are better prepared to find the treasure than your colleague. In fact, I don't see any reason to keep floundering around following the professor's instructions while you beat us to the jackpot each time. I think it would be much better if you did the dirty work, found the treasure, and then just turned it over to me.
Like hell I will.
That's precisely what I'd expect you to say, Miss Creed, which is why I'm glad I don't have to depend on your good-natured cooperation. Kill one of them. I don't care which one.
Wait! Just wait a moment. I'm sure we can work this out.
Work this out? What is there to work out? You'll either find the treasure for me or I shoot your friends. It's pretty simple.
Fine. I'll do it.
See? That wasn't so difficult now, was it? What are you waiting for? I told you to kill one of them.
Anya watched in horror as Bernard's body slumped over on the deck in front of her.
You son of a bitch!
Anya surged to her feet, only to be struck in the face with the butt end of the assault rifle held in her guard's hands.
Anya!
When Anya regained consciousness, she found herself lying on the deck of the Kelly May with the dead for company. The bodies of Jimmy Mitchell and Bernard Reinhardt lay where they had fallen, their blood staining the wood beneath their still forms, their sightless eyes staring. Blaine Michaels and his henchmen were gone. Their boat was nowhere to be seen. Garin was missing too. Anya pushed herself up into a sitting position and was nearly overwhelmed by a wave of dizziness that washed over her. She held still, waiting for it to pass. Her face hurt and her nose throbbed, but a gentle exploration of both with her fingertips told her that nothing seemed to be broken. Swollen, yes, but not broken. When the dizziness had passed and she was reasonably sure she wouldn't vomit, she climbed to her feet.
Hello?
Well, who did you expect? The ghost of Christmas past? You can see there's no one here.
She could, too. There really wasn't all that much more to the boat than she could see. Foredeck, aft deck, and the wheelhouse. From where she stood, she could observe both decks and everything above waist height in the wheelhouse. So unless someone was crouching on the floor of the latter, she was on her own. She wobbled forward on unsteady legs, her equilibrium still out of whack from the blow to the head, and peered inside the wheelhouse. There was no one there. That didn't mean there wasn't anything of interest inside, however. A black cell phone stood on the control panel right next to the throttle, plainly visible from the wheelhouse door. It was one of those disposable models that you could buy in just about any corner store these days. It seemed it had been left there specifically for her. Next to it was the Jeffersonian key that had been secreted inside the porcelain horse. She crossed over to the phone and picked it up. A quick examination showed her that there was a single number stored in the device's memory. She called the number.
Welcome back, Miss Creed.
I'm gonna kill you for what you've done.
You can certainly try.
For a long moment, all Anya could see was red. When she came back to herself, she was clutching her sword in her hand. Releasing her sword back into the otherwhere with a flick of her hand, she realized she'd never unconsciously called her sword before.
Wait, what?
Pay attention, Miss Creed. Your friend's life depends on it.
What did you do with him?
Do? Why, nothing. I simply invited him to accompany us for a bit while you finish the task ahead of you.
If you harm him...
You'll do what, Miss Creed? You're not in a position to do anything but what I tell you to do. And I'm telling you to find the missing treasury if you want to see your friend again.
Fine.
Excellent. Take the phone with you. I'll expect a call from you inside of 72 hours, at which point I'll tell you where to rendezvous with me to turn over the treasure.
72 hours? Are you crazy? I can't possibly find it in that kind of time frame.
You can, and you will. But you can say goodbye to your friend. 72 hours, Miss Creed. That's all you get.
72 hours? How the hell am I supposed to accomplish that?
By moving your ass, girl. Stop whining and get to work.
Anya grabbed the key and the phone. Her gaze flicked across the pair of bodies on the aft deck. They were lying right out in the open, visible to anyone who happened to pass by. And Anya knew she couldn't leave them that way. Something had to be done. Rooting around in the storage compartment at the rear of the boat, Anya found several large tarps, and she used those as a temporary solution to cover the bodies of her friends. She weighed the edges of the tarps down in several places so that the wind wouldn't pick them up and blow them aside once they got underway. She couldn't just leave the boat here in the middle of the river. Bernard deserved better than being left behind like some discarded piece of trash. Jimmy Mitchell did too. She was going to have to bring the boat back to the marina, put it in its proper slip, and hope no one observed her when she made her departure. The dive line and magnetometer were still being towed behind them, so she had to bring those aboard first and stow them. Despite not having seen another boat other than Michael's the entire time they'd been on the river, she was still filled with anxiety as she worked, afraid another vessel was going to come along at any moment and notice something irregular.
Like two corpses on the aft deck. Get off the main river and out of sight for a bit while you figure out what to do.
With that in mind, she went into the wheelhouse and examined the controls after the dive line and magnetometer had been brought aboard and stowed away. The controls seemed fairly intuitive, and the time she'd spent watching Mitchell maneuver the boat earlier that morning would likely be helpful as well. With only a little trouble, she got the engines started and the boat turned around, heading back in the direction from which they'd come. She encountered only one other vessel while out on the open river, a small fishing boat with an outboard motor. As they passed by on the port side, she was filled with a sense of impending doom. Fortunately, the other boat was far too low in the water to allow its passengers to see her deck, never mind figure out what was under the weighted tarp. They passed with a friendly nod and a quick wave, allowing Anya to get back to worrying needlessly. 20 minutes farther along, she spotted the mouth of a tributary large enough to handle the boat and turned in that direction. About a dozen yards down its length, the channel curved sharply to one side. Anything around the bend would be out of sight of the main waterway. It was just what she needed. Once in position, she brought the boat to a stop and shut down the engine. Anya listened for the sound of another engine nearby, but didn't hear one.
I can't bring the boat into dock with two corpses under a tarp on the back deck. They might not be noticed for a day, maybe two, but the minute they start smelling, someone is bound to come aboard and investigate. I need somewhere that I can store them until this entire mess is sorted out.
As it turned out, the answer was right there behind her. A pair of doors was set in the center of the aft deck, a few feet forward of the stern gunwale. Opening them, Anya discovered the refrigerated fish hold. On a working trawler, the fish would be rinsed with high-powered hoses that would push them over the lip of the hatch into the hold below. The refrigeration unit built into the walls of the hold would keep the fish fresh until the boat returned to dock, and the catch was sorted, boxed, and then iced for its journey to the preparation plant. If she could get the bodies into the fish hold, they'd be out of sight and chilled enough to stop major decomposition for the time being. The trouble was, she didn't want to handle them. Not because she was squeamish, but because she didn't want to leave any trace evidence on them if she could help it. She was already going to have a hard enough time explaining things when she got the chance. The problem was partially alleviated, she realized, by the fact that she was still in her neoprene wetsuit. With the hood up and her neoprene dive gloves on, the only part of her body that wasn't completely covered was her face. Even her hair was secured beneath the tight-fitting hood. The fabric of the suit would help repel any blood that got on her, and since she had other clothes to change into, she could always spray herself down with the high-powered hose and then dispose of the suit when she was finished. Satisfied with her plan, or at least as much of a plan as she had, she got to work rigging the rest of the equipment she needed to pull this off. She moved one of the booms into position over the doors to the fish hold and then attached a rope pulley to it. She dug around in the storage lockers until she found a medium-sized net that would be large enough to hold both Jimmy's and Bernard's bodies and laid it out flat beside the hatch. Then, donning her gloves, she took off the tarps and put them aside. She'd deal with them in a bit. Right now, she needed to get the bodies into the net and then maneuver the net over the hatch so she could gently lower the whole contraption to the deck below. She shifted the bodies one at a time and put them in the net. She then attached the hooks on the side of the net to a sling and tied the sling off to the rope she'd threaded through the pulley earlier. She gave all the connections a few tugs and found that they were secure. Satisfied, she moved over to the other end of the rope, sat down on the deck with her back to the gunwale, and started pulling. It went easily at first, until she had taken up the slack. When the weight of the two bodies was pulling against her, she was thankful that she had the pulley, or it would have been all over before it began. Anya managed to lift the net a few inches off the ground, then used the tip of her foot to maneuver it out over the open doors to the hold. The moment it was in position, she let the rope slip through her hands, and the bodies of the two men disappeared into the hold with nary a sound. After that, all the equipment, including the tarps and the pulley itself, were tossed down beside the bodies. She used the high-pressure hose to spray down the deck, flushing the bloodstains out as best she could and sending the water over the side into the river. Then she turned the hose on herself. She changed the setting to low and rinsed every inch of herself. Satisfied that there was no blood on her, she flushed the deck of the boat a final time. She stripped out of her gloves and wetsuit, tossing them into the fish locker with everything else. Last but not least, she closed the hatch and locked it up tight with a padlock she found in the toolbox.
If somebody wants into that fish locker, they're gonna have to work at it.
Having already dug a change of clothing out of her backpack, Anya got dressed. Just being back in her jeans and sweatshirt made her feel better. With the clock ticking down, she didn't have time to waste. She fired up Kelly May's engines and maneuvered her back into the main river channel. Once there, Anya opened up the throttle and headed for the marina as fast as she dared. By the time she drove the boat into the narrow tributary that marked the only entrance to the marina where Mitchell had a slip, she was feeling fairly competent with the controls. That was a good thing, because there was a lot more activity around the marina than there had been on the way out that morning.
Or you just paid more attention to it.
Either way, she was thankful that the wheelhouse was enclosed. Several folks recognized the boat and waved as she went past, and their inability to see her clearly meant she didn't have to explain why she was at the controls instead of Jimmy, or where Jimmy was, for that matter. She carefully maneuvered the boat into its slip and then shut down the engine. She watched the activity going on around her through the darkened wheelhouse windows and waited for her chance. Finally, Anya made a break for it, leaving the boat tied up behind her. Blaine Michaels had given Anya just 72 hours to solve the final clues and find the treasure. That wasn't a lot of time to begin with, and she'd wasted several hours of it getting the boat back to dock. Anya was feeling the pressure as she got inside the rental car and pulled out of the marina. She recited the third clue again to herself as she drove.
Take the rifle to the place of Lee's greatest failure, where the peacock freely roamed. Find the spot where my doppelganger rests eternal, deep beneath the loam.
The Lee in Lee's greatest failure was most likely Robert E. Lee. No other Lee held greater significance for the South. Parker would have known that his executive officer, Sykes, would understand who he was referring to immediately. That meant, in order to locate her next destination, she had to figure out the place and time where Lee had failed more spectacularly than at any other. That it was most likely a battlefield went without saying. While Lee had his share of troubles as a young man, none of his personal failures would have meant as much to Captain Parker as the events that unfurled in the closing days of the war. Anya considered the major battles where Lee had been defeated. There was Cheat Mountain. He'd earned the nickname Granny Lee when his vastly superior Confederate force of 15,000 men had been unable to defeat 2,000 Union soldiers. 7 days, South Mountain, and Antietam in 1862, Gettysburg in 1863, of course, followed by the tactical draws of the Wilderness, Spotsylvania, and Cold Harbor. The final defeat of the Army of Northern Virginia, the backbone of the Confederate armed forces at Appomattox in 1865. It hadn't been a failure in the sense that Lee had done something tactically wrong. He'd simply run out of the food, ammunition, and the men he needed to keep the war effort going.
Well, scratch off Appomattox.
Likewise, she could forget about the battles in the early part of the war as well. Cheat Mountain, South Mountain, the 7 days, none of them had any major impact on the success or failure of the war overall. Both sides had been feeling each other out, getting a sense of this thing called civil war. That left her with two choices.
Antietam and Gettysburg.
Gettysburg might be better known to the average American, she thought, but it was Antietam that held the most significance for the war effort. Lee had chosen to ignore his advisors and push north into Union territory, rather than try to defend Vicksburg. His immediate goal had been to secure desperately needed supplies from the rich farm country of Pennsylvania. But his decision proved to be a monumental error. Antietam proved to be the bloodiest single-day battle in the entire Civil War, with more than 25,000 casualties. It was the first major battle fought on Union soil, but it did not turn out the way Lee had hoped. The Confederacy lost control of its western region, and Lee himself nearly lost his army. He'd been forced to fight his way clear at Gettysburg, and the Antietam campaign had been the last time Lee invaded Northern Territory. From that point on, it had all been downhill. There wouldn't have even been a Gettysburg if Lee hadn't lost the fight at Antietam.
Lee's greatest failure was, therefore, Antietam.
That was where she had to go next. It was all well and good, except for the fact that Sharpsburg, Maryland, was more than 400 miles from her current location in northern Georgia. She was looking at 7, maybe 8 hours of driving time, and that was without any major stops. There had to be an easier way. Anya drove a bit farther until she saw a fast food restaurant ahead of her. She pulled into the lot and found a place to park. Taking her laptop out of her backpack, she fired it up and connected to the restaurant's free Wi-Fi service. Just a few moments later, she connected to an online travel site and was looking to find the fastest and easiest way to get to Maryland. As it turned out, Antietam was only 50 miles or so away from Washington, D.C. If she could catch a flight into Washington from either Atlanta or Savannah and rent a car on the other end, she could save herself several hours.
And if you rest on the plane, you might actually start to feel like a human being again.
She checked the flight schedules. Atlanta sounded like the more logical choice, as it was the bigger airport. But as it turned out, a flight leaving Savannah at 5:20 p.m. not only got her into Washington sooner, but it saved her additional driving time as she was closer to that airport. She booked the flight and then took a moment to check her email. There were several messages from Commissaire LaRoche, first asking and then demanding that she get in touch. She didn't have time to deal with him, so she simply deleted the messages, telling herself she'd get in touch when this was all said and done. Right now, she needed to focus on finding the treasure and freeing Garin. Realizing it had been hours since she'd eaten, Anya went to the drive-thru, picking up a soda and a few cheeseburgers for the ride. As she was waiting for her order, three police cars went roaring past the restaurant, heading in the direction of the marina. The police could have been going anywhere, responding to 100 different calls, but upon seeing them, Anya was convinced that the bodies aboard the Kelly May had been found, and that any minute now they'd realize where she was and come looking for her.
The sooner I get out of here, the better.
The server handed over her order, and Anya drove off, getting on the highway and heading south towards Savannah as quickly as she dared.